Well, hello out there, my friends. It's totally spooky season, October. Still, always, forever, all year. But it's actually October now. It's 4 a.m. Yeah, I'm awake on a Friday. I didn't do the podcast on the Thursday to release today, but I'm going to get this sucker out now. How are you doing out there? Why am I whispering? Because it's dark. No, I like the quiet mornings sometimes. Got my coffee. Anyone else out there like me? I actually went to sleep pretty early thinking I was going to drive to the coast today and changed my mind and decided to stay here and do some more work. I've been working on my omnibus, which is, it's got some vampires in it. And so I figured I would just march on through, continue on through, and get to the third book editing, putting that out by Halloween. It actually is very fitting for the subject of today's podcast. The other reason this podcast is probably coming about is my own obsession with vampires and my new obsession with Interview with the Vampire. Oh my God, did you guys watch it? If you don't, it is the reason to have AMC Plus, unless you just don't like vampires. And if you're out there going, but Sherry, I read the books and I love the movie, and I know, so did I. So have I. It's a lovely little movie. But I'm here to tell you that the show, Interview with the Vampire, is, oh my God. I was stunned. I was stunned at how good it is. And let's talk a little bit about Mr. Sam Reed, who is playing Lestat. And he is the most Lestat who ever Lestatted. He's more Lestat than Lestat. I'm here to tell you. I promise you. Okay, there might be a couple people who disagree with me, but I'm telling you, oh my God, it's stunning, sybaritic, scary, sensual, beautiful, well-acted. I'm totally obsessed. All of the people I know who read and loved Interview with the Vampire agree.
They love it.
Yes, there were a few little changes, but I actually feel that it's truer to the book. There's some big-ass changes in that movie, in case you forgot. There really are. And while Tom Cruise was, shocked me with that he was better than I expected, do you remember when Anne Rice took out that whole ad? Was it in the New York Times? About how upset she was about that casting? She retracted it later, but he did all right. But he did not get all of the facets of Lestat, and Sam does, and I didn't know who Sam was before this, but I sure as hell know who he is now. And then we have Jacob, who I am blanking on his last name, who's playing Louis, but Game of Thrones fans, you recognize him as Grey Worm, and it's so wonderful to see him do, way more dialogue and do something else. He's just wonderful, going from the present day interviews where Louis become very detached, and very tightly in control and kind of icy, juxtaposed with this, in the past where he wasn't. Trust me, give it a try. Absolutely love it. Cannot wait for episode 3 Sunday. I feel like I was going to say something else, but please give it a chance. Okay, I made my pitch. It's a gorgeous thing. Sam Reed is a gorgeous thing. Yes, I'm completely obsessed with Sam Reed now. Or maybe I'm just obsessed with his Lestat. Oh, another tidbit about Sam. I love when things like this happen. Apparently he read old books when he was a teenager, started reading them then, and he really likes vampires. So see, we love him already. And when he heard there was going to be a show, he put together a tape and he got to audition and he got the part. I love that. I love when someone who is a fan and kind of geeky about something gets to be a part of it. Because I'm also thinking, if you watch The Witcher and Henry Cavill, right? Total Witcher geek. Totally, he plays the video games and he's Team Yennefer. The only way to be. And he got to play Geralt the Witcher. I think that's really cool. And they must be so excited. Now, why all the vampire talk this morning? Because I'm going to start talking about some vampires, that's why. I mean, what October would be complete without some vampires? And I may kick this off as a part one, because today I'm going to do a little shorter episode and just give you the lowdown on some vampiric type beings from some different countries. And to start this off, I'll just quickly tell you that vampire myths go back just ancient Mesopotamia, Egypt. There's some type of vampiric creature way back, and that is something I may explore with you in another podcast of a very deep dive of where do they originate, etc., etc. But today I'm just going to tell you about a few, and I'm thinking that we'll start in Greece because I do have a fondness for ancient Greece. Vampires are some of the most famous creatures of horror and now romance genres. Yeah, we all love our vampires now, don't we? Remember, they used to be scary. I wonder what people from ancient times would think of us drooling and swooning over, you know, TV show like I just mentioned. They must think we're nuts. The folklore of countless cultures around the world features some sort of vampire figure, as I said, and Greece has the Vrykolakas. Now, the Greek vampire is an undead, fearsome creature that becomes more powerful the longer it is allowed to feed. Belief in the Vrykolakas was widespread in Greece, particularly in rural regions, up until the mid-20th century, although many still might believe in the creature to this day. Both the term Vrykolakas and the figure itself possibly come from neighboring Slavic countries, where vampire legends, as we all know, are widespread and feature prominently in folklore. The Slavic word Varkolak is probably the root of many terms for vampire-like figures throughout Eastern Europe and the Balkans. Actually meaning something like werewolf, it came to represent vampires in most Slavic countries. Although Vrykolakas shares many similarities to Slavic vampires, there are some differences. The Greek vampire does not drink blood, but it feasts on the flesh and liver of its victims, more like a contemporary zombie figure. Not brains, but the flesh eating is what makes it a bit strange. There are also many creatures from ancient Greek mythology that resemble vampires, other creatures, such as the Empusae, Lamia, Mormo, and the Striges. The Empusae were shapeshifters who would often take the form of beautiful women. They had one leg made of brass that was apparently controlled by Hecate. You know, she's my favorite witch. These creatures seduced and fed on the bodies of young men in Greek mythology. Similarly, the Lamia is a spine-chilling ancient Greek female shapeshifter who consumes human flesh, particularly children. Perhaps most famously, Lamia was portrayed in Greek playwright Aristophanes' 5th century BC comedy, Peace. Doesn't sound like it would be very funny, but I'm sure he did well. The ancient commentaries on Aristophanes' play explain the role Lamia played in Greek mythology. She was a queen of what is now Libya, who was beloved by Zeus, the greatest of all Greek gods, at least he thinks he is. When Zeus's wife, Hera, robbed her of her children that resulted from this union, Lamia went on a killing spree, destroying every child she could lure into her power. Athenian mothers were even known to use her as a threat to frighten children who were misbehaving. Side note here, I mean, some people wonder about our so-called fairy tales or the tales that the Grimm collected and how come they're so awful if you get the original versions. Because dudes and dudettes, you're telling your children these stories not because it's some pretty little story. You're telling them so they act right and fly straight and don't do stupid shit. That's why you're telling these things. Moving on, we have the Mormo, or fearful one, who resembles a Lamia, and she's also a female spirit that is said to consume children. Seems to be quite the fear, doesn't it? Or fetish, or something, all this children eating. To this day, Greek mothers and caretakers invoke the creature to frighten their misbehaving children. The Strix, or plural, Striges, referred to a flesh-eating mythical bird that resembles a mix of an owl and a bat. Okay, I'm picturing it. Sounds kind of cute to me, but then maybe I'm just weird. This bird creature is nocturnal, with a large, pointed beak and terrible claws. It's said to also eat infants. And it might be a witch in disguise, which I was just thinking to myself, you know, stridges, like, yeah, I usually have thought of them as, I guess, shape-shifting witches. There are many ways you might become a vrikolakis in Greek folklore. Most often, it's people who were excommunicated from the church for sacrilegious behavior, and those who were buried in unconsecrated ground were believed to transform into vampires. That's a very common thread when it comes to vampires. During World War II, Greece suffered the Great Famine. During this time, 300,000 people starved to death. The number of dead during this time caused cemeteries to overflow, and many people were forced to bury their loved ones outside of graveyards in mass graves. This caused, as you might imagine, great distress across the country. And belief in the Vrikolakis was so ingrained in many of Greek peoples that they feared that their relatives would become vampires because they were not buried in cemeteries. Some families were so frightened of the horrific transformation that they beheaded the corpses of their loved ones before they were buried to avoid them becoming vampires. In some regions, people believed that eating the meat from sheep that had been wounded by a wolf or a werewolf would cause vampiric transformation. So that one's really specific. Legend states that the body of the Vrikolakis, although dead, doesn't decay, but it does become very stocky, and it can take on a healthy, ruddy complexion due to its diet of flesh and blood. It's quite different from some other depictions of vampires as being pale and sickly, so this one doesn't look like that at all. Those with red hair and light eyes were often suspected of being vampires, as they resembled Slavic peoples whose folklore was full of such figures. Can you imagine? I've got red hair and green eyes. Oh my God, killer! Vampires in Greece were thought to bring great destruction to villages, as you might imagine. They were nomadic, roamed the country in search of victims to torment and feed upon. In several stories, Vrikolakis is even described as bringing disease and epidemic to villages across Greece. It is said to kill victims by sitting on them or crushing them as they sleep, and then later feeding on their flesh and organs, particularly the liver. Many, of course, have attributed this legend to sleep paralysis, which I have done a podcast about. It's also sometimes called old hag syndrome. There's probably other words for it, but it's the condition that, you know, you may have experienced it, where you feel like you're awake, but you can't move, right? What it is, if I can remember even just generally how I in the podcast that I did, is some sort of slight disconnect, nothing abnormal, between your brain and your body. Your body is starting to wake up, but your brain doesn't quite know it yet, to put it simply. And so for a little while there, it feels like forever because it's scary, but it really doesn't last terribly long. You really can't move. You really can't. But it's not uncommon. And this can probably account for a lot of ghost stories. Just a little FYI. Now, those who have sleep paralysis might also hallucinate. So you could see figures or frightening images around you, because again, it kind of happens between your brain and your body. The most persistent Greek vampire legend, and is apparently one that many still believe in rural Greece today, involves knocking on doors. In Greek folklore, the Vrikolakis roam villages, and they knock on your door and call out the names of those who live there. Sherry, don't open the door. If no one answers this initial knocking, the vampire will go away and they won't bother you, so don't answer the door. But if someone opens the door, the Vrikolakis will cause them to die a few days later, and they too will become a vampire, as legend has it. So again, don't open the door, okay? Don't open the door when somebody knocks on the door. You're going to be a fucking vampire. Got it? Don't ever open your door if you don't know who it is. That's just probably a wise tip there. Don't open your door to strangers. That's probably what that is. But it's much better thinking it's a vampire, isn't it? Much more fun. In order to kill one, because this is important, right? We should probably know this. In order to kill the Vricolacas, one must attempt to destroy its body by impaling, beheading, or cremating the vampire while it sleeps in its grave. And this only happens on Saturday. I'm sure it's in my vampire encyclopedia, which is sitting right here in front of me. But I don't remember hearing this before of vampires only sleeping on Saturdays. So there you have it. Maybe that's why we can go out and party on Saturday nights. But while you're out partying, maybe go, you know, check on those graves. By destroying the body of the creature, it's, of course, then believed, like in a lot of vampiric tales, that this creature is free. And now the Vricolacas can rest, or, you know, now it's not going to be a Vricolacas anymore. Archaeologists have also discovered many graves across Greece, particularly from the Ottoman period, that will show you how widespread this belief was. For example, a tomb found on the island of Lesbos during the Ottoman period contained a body with nails pierced through its neck, pelvis, and feet, which pinned it down to the grave. Here's another thing that I've mentioned before, or, well, I use them, it's come up in my stories. Stakes in corpses weren't necessarily always through the heart, or even most of the time through the heart. And a lot of times a body might be buried face down with the stake through its middle, you know, somewhere in the middle. Why? To pin it down. It wasn't so much about, here, let's kill it and stake its heart. It's, let's keep this fucker down in the grave so it can't get up. Little more trivia for you. In order to keep vampires away, Greeks had a variety of apotropaix, which is ancient Greek for turn away, or items and practices used to keep supernatural creatures, such as vampires, away. They also would bury a corpse face down or put scythes near the grave to prevent any demons or evil spirits from entering the body, and it was thought to prevent the transformation into a vampire. Greeks also placed small wax crosses and pieces of pottery with the word Jesus Christ conquers in the grave to ward off evil. The practice resembles the ancient Greek tradition of placing a coin in the corpse's mouth, both to pay their toll across the river Styx and to ward off evil spirits. Garlic and the omnipresent evil eye are also widely used to ward off evil spirits and the Vricolacas to this very day in Greece. And now some more little side trivia for you from me. Garlic doesn't necessarily have only a connection, or wasn't even in the first place just a connection with the vampires in general. And I forget why, because this is mostly about my vampiric knowledge. It was to keep anything evil away. But I think, as I recall, I know reading about vampires specifically, a lot of time it was actually the flowers of the garlic. And they might also use roses. And I'm pretty sure my Christian listeners can let me know that there was a reason that roses were sacred. But most of these things have to do with warding off evil and not necessarily specifically vampires. Also, in one region, they burned arsenic, I believe it was. The alchemists used it to ward off evil and used it for various other things. And it had a similar fragrance to garlic. And garlic is much cheaper than arsenic and easier for peasants to get hold of at the time. And so they used garlic. And this was in, I believe, northern France, off the top of my head. How do you like that? I'm just full of useless or useful, depending on your point of view, little trivia, if I'm remembering it correctly. But let's move on, shall we? Valraven. In Danish folklore, a Valraven, or Raven of the Slain, is a supernatural raven. Ravens appear in traditional Danish folk songs where they are described as originating from ravens who consume the bodies of the dead on the battlefield and capable of turning into the form of a knight after consuming the heart of a child. Here we go again, more children eating. And alternately, they could maybe be half-wolf and half-raven creatures. So, okay, I'm kind of sliding to the left here of vampires, but still, I thought this one was cool. According to Danish folklore, recorded in the late 1800s, when a king or chieftain was killed in battle and not found and buried, ravens came and ate him. Which, of course, ravens do clean up roadkill and other dead. That's one of their useful functions. They do, and crows, feed. They scavenge, a bit like vultures. Ravens became Valraven, The vile raven that ate the king's heart gained human knowledge and could perform great malicious acts, could lead people astray, and had superhuman powers, and they were terrible animals. I would say that a lot of people see crows and ravens, corvids in general, as pests or frightening, and I think it's because what I always say is, you just don't like them because they're smarter than you, because they are very smart. In another account, a Val Raven is described as a peaceless soul, and it's in search of redemption, and it flies by night, never during the day, and can only free itself from its animal countenance by consuming the blood of a child. Here comes the vampiric part. This is reflected in a Danish traditional song that describes how, after refusing offers of riches, the Val Raven makes an agreement with a maiden to take her to her betrothed after she promises the Val Raven her firstborn son. After the agreement, the Val Raven flies away. In time, the couple have a child, and of course the Val Raven returns. He asks the maiden if she has forgotten her promise. The Val Raven takes the child away and tears into its chest and consumes the blood contained within the child's heart. As a result, the Val Raven transforms into a knight. This traditional song was reinterpreted by the electro folk band Sorten Mold, FYI, and it became a big hit for them in 1997 under the title Ravnen, which I'm probably pronouncing all of these things incorrectly, R-A-V-N-E-N, and Val Raven is V-A-L. R-A-V-N. According to 19th century scholar Jacob Grimm, the Vidraven of Wild Valraven, Wild Raven or Wild Valraven, take exactly the place of the diabolical Trold in Danish folk songs. Grimm proposes an old High German equivalent to the Danish Valraven, Walharban. I will tell you in a minute. Well, hang on, I'll tell you right now. If you didn't know what Trold was, of course it's a troll. It's also in Norse mythology. In Old Norse sources, beings described as trolls dwell in isolated areas of rocks, mountains, or caves, live together in small family units, and are rarely ever helpful to human beings. The Val Raven has inspired occasional pop culture references. Can you hear that? My cat is up playing with his toy. If you hear the crinkle, it's my cat, and now he's doing the soft shoe dance. I wish you could see it. You gonna bury it? Are you done? Okay. Where was I? Pop culture references, including a 20th century book of short stories, as well as the Feroze? Oh my God, I'm butchering it. F-A-R-O-E-S-E, Feroze, musical group bearing the name Valraven, and they play a form of traditional music. It was also the title of a Danish Germanic neo-pagan magazine published from 2002 to 2007. It's also mentioned in children's books. There's a 2017 video game, Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice, which features Valraven as God of Illusion, and it's a boss that the player must defeat to get, you know, carry on in the game. Of course, if you play video games, you know what it is. They appear as enemies in the Bestiary of Pathfinder role-playing game, using Grimm's Wildraven as a name for the creature. It's also the name of Cedar Point's 2016 dive roller coaster. They feature in the fantasy novel The Absolute Book by Elizabeth Knox. A Valraven named Val is featured as a companion to a Reaper in the supernatural thriller novel Bleed More, Body More. And that's 2021. These are very recent, by Ian Kirkpatrick. Valraven's Claw is a short sword available in the Ubisoft title Assassin's Creed Valhalla as a redeemable reward on Ubisoft Connect. Now, I've played Valhalla, and I was like, yeah, wait a second, that's familiar. So that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And now, slightly adjacent, in Swedish, there is a saying that I will probably now butcher. Katban hamanga nam, which essentially translates to, we have many names for the things we love. This is fitting for the topic, the mysterious Drager. The Drager, also known as Dragen, Dragur, or Draeger, is an undead being known from the sagas, folktales, and Sagja, Old Norse. The word may be related to the Swedish word drog, which, according to the Svenskt The Lexicon means a pale, ineffectual, and slow-minded person that drags himself along. Very reminiscent of the name, it's almost like drag, right? In medieval contexts, they have also been called Hagpui, which is barrow dwellers, or Uptranga, again walker, like it's rising to walk again, right? But what exactly are Draga, and what is their connection to archaeology, if any? Well, in folktales, many Draga have some type of connection to burial mounds. They are deceased loved ones who come back to life in their graves or tombs with the primary purpose of protecting the treasures that they were buried with. They're a type of revenant in their physical body, as opposed to something more ethereal like a ghost, and they can actually put up a fight if you provoke them. But why would you ever do that? Well, that depends on what the prize is that's at stake. Hagbrot is the Norwegian word translating to mound breaking, and describes the act of breaking and entering into a grave, often desecrating it in the process, of course, though there is a theory currently that suggests it might have been sometimes socially sanctioned. Hagbrot are a common occurrence in relation to mounds, with a majority of grave mounds showing the evidence of some type of desecration or break-in. There's also evidence of mounds without graves, cenotaphs, which were reopened in a similar manner. There's no general consensus between archaeologists and historians as to why Hagbrot were committed, but there are theories, of course. The historical accounts of them occurring in the form of sagas and legends, though, don't at all explain why it happened, because that's not the purpose of the sagas, right? That's not why they were written. One of the accounts is Grettir's saga, written in the 14th century, but it was probably told before that. And it tells the story of Grettir Asmundarson, an Icelandic outlaw living in the 11th century. The stories are written down as real events, although the authenticity can be discussed, but we're not going to discuss that here. Grettir is no stranger to Hagbrot and commits several of these offenses himself. A good example is the mound belonging to Kar in Gamle, or Kar the Old, the father of a chieftain in Mor and Romsdal, Norway. Grettir decides to break into the mound in order to get his hands on the treasures, and it's there that he has to get through his first battle with a Draugr. Since video games came up a while ago, I mean, yeah, this is like wandering around in the open world somewhere, and you're like, ooh, let's go check this place out. Oh, wait, you have to fight the wraith before you get the treasure, right? Probably where they get the idea in the first place, of course, for this in the video games. I mean, you think they just pull this out of their asses? Yeah, if you play video games much, or certain types of video games, you'll know that they get a lot of it from actual folk tales and sagas and etc. See, video games can be educational. Edumacational? Yeah, something like that. Where were we? So he's trying to get the treasure. Kar has become a living dead man, jealously guarding his own mound and all of his treasure. But Grettir wins the battle, spoiler alert, and he walks away with some of this treasure, including an heirloom sword called Kar's Notter, or Kar's Gift. They even have an illustration of this dude. I'll have to share that. Pinky_podcast, that's the Instagram. The Hagbrot could occur near the time of the creation of the mound, while others would happen hundreds of years after the fact, and, you know, etc. Just pretty much any time. The most general theories and likely reasons behind Hagbrot have been summarized as the following. And yes, this is archaeology. Did I not say that? Yeah, we went from the spooky to archaeology. Because I'm good like that. Grave robberies in search of golden treasures, to collect symbolic objects and heirlooms, socially sanctioned, like funerary ritual purposes, to remove the dead to be reburied somewhere else, and here we go, to prevent the dead from returning, the Reimlik motive. Robbing a grave, of course, in search of gold is very self-explanatory and happens worldwide. You have people going into the Egyptian tombs and pyramids, you know. That happens. Collecting heirlooms from a mound might have been seen as a way to get the power of the dead person, which is interesting. This is seen particularly in the Middle Ages. It was a very common belief. You have examples from the sagas of weapons acquired from mounds and gaining powers from the dead. this ties into the ritualistic aspect, but another possibility of committing hogbrats would be to take power away from the dead. The people buried inside of the mounds would have been incredibly powerful while alive, and so the thought might have been that destroying their resting place was a way to take away some of this power. Maybe they were afraid of them being ghosts. I also have a really nice picture here that I can show you of the Norinara runestone from Denmark, and it's interpreted as having a so-called grave-binding inscription that is used to keep the deceased in the grave. They're like a type of rune. There's many examples in different cultures in which the partial goal of the burial is to actually keep the dead in the grave, prevent them from coming back to life. There are rituals or burials in Finland and Poland where the dead have been placed with heavy boulders or penetrated with wooden stakes, right? In other words, like I told you, pinned down. This is referred to as Reimlich motive when you discuss Hogbrat, and it could be a reason for why the mound break-ins occurred so frequently. Now let's get to the meat of it, eh? The role of the Draugr in the tales of Hogbrat is interesting and can be interpreted in many ways. They may be interpreted as a cautionary tale to prevent people from breaking into and stealing objects from the mounds. They are often described as protectors of the mound when they are in the context of burials. But Draugr appear in many other contexts as well, and they are more hostile and out for blood. Perhaps the most well-known and terrifying example of a Draugr is that of Glamr. He is mentioned in Grettir's saga, and though not explicitly mentioned as a Draugr in text, just called a troll, actually, he plays the part very well. Glamr is a Swedish woodcutter who is asked to watch the sheep for a farmer named Thorhall on his farmstead. Glamr is the only one in the area who is willing to do this job because the farmer's sheep are haunted. What the hell is a haunted sheep doing running around like meh, meh, meh? For no good reason? Don't they do that anyway? Sorry, I don't know. It's early, like I told you. To make this worse, Glamr decides not to take part in the traditional Yuletide feast because he's doesn't believe in it, or he's just freaking stubborn. Quote from the saga itself here. There was a church near the byre, but Glamr never crossed the threshold. He hated solemnity. Apparently he was an indifferent Christian. On the vigil of the nativity, Glamr rose early and shouted for meat. Meat! Exclaimed the housewife. No man calling himself a Christian touches flesh today. Tomorrow is the Holy Christmas Day, and this is a fast. All superstition, roared Glamr. As far as I can see, men are no better now than they were in the bonny heathen time. Bring me meat, and make no more ado about it. You may be quite certain, protested the goodwife, if church rule be not kept, ill luck will follow. Glamr ground his teeth and clenched his hands. Meat! I will have meat, or... In fear and trembling, the poor woman obeyed. Don't ask me why I just did that. I've been watching The Last Kingdom. I tried to stop myself from doing it, so it's even worse. The following day, Glamr does not return from his work. And by the way, it's probably not going to stop me from doing it. And a group of people decide to try to find him, and in the end, they are successful. Presently, the whole party were called together about a trampled spot in the heath where evidently a death struggle had taken place, for earth and stone were tossed about, and the snow was blotched with large splashes of blood. A gory track led up the mountain, and the farm servants were following it, when a cry, almost of agony, from one of the lads made them turn. In looking behind a rock, the boy had come upon the corpse of the shepherd. It was livid and swollen to the size of a bullock. It lay on its back with the arms extended. The snow had been scrabbled up by the puffed hands in the death agony, and the staring glassy eyes glazed out of the ashen gray, upturned face into the vaporous canopy overhead. From the purple lips lolled the tongue, which in the last throes had been bitten through by the white fangs, and a discolored stream which had flowed from it was now an icicle. The following night, Glamour comes back and begins to kill the living things around him. We learn that those slain by Draugr are forced to reawaken as a Draugr themselves, and this is likely what happened to poor Glamour. Glam began afresh to wax mighty, and such deeds he wrought, that all men fled away from Thor Hallstead, except the good man and his good wife. Now, after midwinter, one morning the housewife fared to the byre to milk the cows after the wonted time. By then it was broad daylight, for none other than the Nethert would trust themselves out before the day. But he went out at dawn. She heard great cracking in the byre, with bellowing and roaring. She ran back, crying out, and said she knew not what uncouth things were going on in the byre. The bonder went out and came to the cows, which were goring one another. So he thought it not good to go in there, but went into the hay barn. There he saw where lay the Nethert, and had his head in one noose and his feet in the other, and he cast on his back. The bonder went up to him and felt him all over with his hand, and find soon that he was dead, and the spine of him broken asunder. It had been broken over the raised stone edge of a goose. I gotta stop here a moment. I can't tell if this is in the way they've written this italics. Boos? It's not a noose. Hoos? Boos? Ah. You know, it's really pretty font, you guys, but I don't know what you said. Okay, I totally broke that fucking spell. Now the good men thought there was no abiding there longer. So he fled away from the farm with all that he might take away. But all such livestock was as left behind Glam killed. And then he fared all over the valley and destroyed farms. But Thornhall was with his friends the rest of the winter. Glamour is later slain by Grettir after an epic battle, but Grettir ends up paying a price that is higher than what he expected. He has been cursed and suddenly becomes catastrophically unlucky, doomed to loneliness and afraid of the dark. The eyes of the corpse were fixed on Grettir, lit with the cold glare of the moon. His head swam as his heart sent a hot stream to his brain. Then a voice from the grey lips said, "Thou hast acted madly in seeking to match thyself with me. Now learn that henceforth ill luck shall constantly attend thee, that thy strength shall never exceed what it is now, and that by night these eyes of mine shall stare at thee through the darkness till the dying day, so that for very horror thou shalt not endure to be alone." What Glamour had predicted came to pass. Never again did Grettir dare to be alone in the dark. With this story, we see the Draugr play a very different role to that of a protector. He is vengeful, brutal, and out for blood. Which version best represented the supernatural being is difficult to say, but it's easy to imagine which version scared people more. That would be fucking terrifying. So, yeah, you know, I should have just gone all in on whatever the hell that terrible accent was that I was trying not to do, to do, whatever. What the, I should have just gone for it. Why not? Because we gotta have fun here, especially in the wee hours of the morning. And now we're going to go to China. Jiangxi. Terrifying Chinese hopping. Vampires. That's not even, I don't even know what that is. Don't ask me. It's early hours of AM. That's what the fuck it is. So I don't know how many of you out there have watched copious amounts of vampire flicks or have ever seen the Asian version of them, especially the hopping vampires, but fucking terrifying, okay? Let's just go straight to history101.com. The world is filled with monsters, both real and imaginary. Common beasties such as ghosts, vampires, werewolves, and zombies have existed in the human imagination for millennia. But some creatures are more obscure than others. While those from China, Taiwan, Japan, and other Asian nations may be familiar with the lore of the Jiangxi, many Western audiences are dangerously ill-informed. The Jiangxi are undead humans that have hunted, fed from, and infected the living for thousands of years. They are unique in that they do not walk, stumble, or stagger. They hop. Now that might seem funny, but they're excellent jumpers. This means they can suddenly appear right in front of you or behind you. So if you're a person who doesn't like surprises, you probably wouldn't like it too much, my friends. Now, these creatures aren't actually a result of ancient evil forces. They were created by the same people who came to fear them. This story begins over 2,000 years ago, before the unification of China. Qin Shi Huang, the first emperor of China, was still in the process of conquering the Chinese states when Jiangxi were born. It's possible that without Qin Shi Huang's war of unification, the hopping vampires would never exist. You see, Jiangxi used to be living, breathing, thinking human beings, of course, like any good vampire. Warriors deployed to maintain state borders and fight off Qin Shi Huang's forces often traveled far from home, and so many of them died in battle. Because their families could not afford to have their bodies sent home, it was very stressful for them. You know, respect and burying your dead, and for some still is, a very sacred thing. And it's a very, very distressing, horrible, horrifying thing if you could not have the body of your loved ones and lay them to rest properly. And because, of course, of so many also death beliefs about rising from the dead or not making it to the promised lands, wherever those may be for your culture. Very sacred, very big deal. So to get some kind of closure and maybe the body of the lost loved one, they turned to Taoist priests. The priest would perform a sacred ritual to contact the body and the soul. They would then give the dead person a specific set of instructions to allow them to return home. And because of rigor mortis, which, you know, causes your body to become stiff, the priests encouraged the dead to hop their way back to loved ones. Jiangxi literally translates into stiff course. The living dead seemed to be pretty innocent, at least at first. So how did they become vampires? It's unlikely that any of the original Jiangxi ever returned home to their families, of course. Grieving families who had placed their trust in local priests didn't lose their faith after their loved ones remained lost, though. Instead, they assumed that something had gone horribly wrong during the ritual. In their eyes, the dearly departed family member had reanimated, but had lost a good part of their soul. An undead creature that has lost all of its kindness and grace can only become pure evil. Consequently, the vampire like Jiangxi that we know and fear today was born. It was only able to move around during the night, and the beings represented the fear of death, the unknown, and the dark. They could be created through a violent death or suicide, an improper burial, or a late burial. Unlike vampires in Eastern Europe, Jiangxi could not escape from their graves. Instead, they were a product of neglect. One can only imagine how many corpses lined the early roads and fields of ancient China during Qin Shi Huang's wars. These poor souls that remained unburied transformed into Jiangxi during the night. That was accomplished through energy absorption. Moonlight or starlight shining down on an unburied body would become vital energy, and the body would consume this, allowing it to reanimate. This reminds me a little bit of, you know, there's such a belief now, because of film, that vampires cannot go in the sun. I am here to burst your bubble and tell you that even though it's a really cool thing, okay, it's a cool weakness and it makes for great cinematic repulsions and explosions and, you know, ashes and all kinds of sparkly things, that was not original to folklore. Of course, only bat, you know, the scary evil things come out at night. In the light of day, and especially during the height of the belief in God's light, right, such evil could not be in the sun, in the light of the sun. That's what that was. Or they were really nocturnal. Like I said, all the oogie boogies come out at night. Imagine you don't have electricity. The nighttime is scary, y'all. Okay? It's very simple. And even in the famous stories like Bram Stoker's Dracula, Dracula doesn't die in the sun. Okay? Varney the Vampire, the Feast of Blood, does not die in the sun. However, the reason I'm bringing this up with this aside is that he could become more powerful in moonlight or heal in moonlight,
which is making me wonder, and I do have all 1,500 plus pages of Varney the Vampire around here somewhere, if that belief at all kind of came from the Chinese, if Reimer had heard of that when he wrote it, or just was just a coincidence. But it made me stop and think about it. There is your little tidbit about the sunshine thing. So, okay, since I'm digressing, I remember when Twilight, the books, and all of those things came out, and people arguing about them. You know, say what you want about them, whether they're good or bad or silly or whatever it is you think about them. There was one thing that I would actually always defend about it, because people made a big stink about the fact that you can't have vampires come out in the sun, and they were upset with her because you can't have vampires come out in the sun. Here's the thing. As I just told you, yes, you can. She didn't do that wrong. She's not wrong. Okay? Never mind that she never read vampire fiction and never watched vampire films, but somehow she still got that right. And it's funny to me because everybody's heard of Dracula, but that is a tidbit that they don't know about Dracula. You just know the movies. Ooh, I'm not trying to lecture you. I sound like I'm lecturing you. This really should be saved for an actual full-on vampire podcast, shouldn't it, that I said I might do. Didn't I actually kind of do this? Well, I've spoken of Bela Lugosi and other. I've probably mentioned these things before. As far as the sparkling, though, y'all, I have no freaking clue. I cannot defend that. I have no idea why they freaking sparkle, okay? But going in the sunlight is not against the rules. Furthermore, it's fiction. She can do whatever the hell she wants. The day that a vampire walks up to you and says, yeah, you know that whole sun thing? Makes me kind of crispy. You can just assume that you can do whatever the hell you want. Okay, I said it. I'm done. Let's get back to Jiangxi. Now that you know how they were created and why they hop, would you recognize one if you saw one? Maybe not. The description of Jiangxi's appearance greatly varies, but there are a few commonalities. So in other words, if you don't see them hopping, you might not know what it is. They do tend to retain their human form, but they have pale, whitish-green skin. Some may even be able to transform into floating balls of light that help them lure victims, much like an anglerfish uses bioluminescence to lure prey. A Jiangxi's hair may be white or green, just like their skin. Their mouth is full of sharp, serrated teeth, like a shark. Some are said to have long, thick fingernails that cannot be broken or split. The nails are sharp enough to cut, stab, or impale you. A Jiangxi's breath is so horrifically bad that some people believe a single breath in your face can kill you. So carry with y'all some breath mints, gum, you know, maybe it'll get stuck in their teeth, mouthwash. A strange glowing green mold seems to take hold of many Jiangxi, allowing them to glow slightly themselves. In a few accounts, the monster kind of looks like Gene Simmons of the rock group Kiss. Like, no, really. It has a long tongue, big bulging eyes, and a gaudy costume. Of course, instead of black leather or spandex, it's wearing clothing that dates back to the Qing Dynasty. How do you avoid a hungry Jiangxi? Because this is going to be very useful information. It's well equipped for murder, but it doesn't often cause immediate or noticeable physical harm in its victims. Unlike vampires, as was kind of touched upon, it doesn't exist on blood. And unlike zombies, there is no craving for human brains or flesh. It feeds on energy, qi, also referred to as qi in many Western countries, is a person's vital life force. Without it, you die. So this is a Jiangxi's favorite snack. It's an energy vampire, y'all. You know any of those? Because I think we have all known a few energy vampires. So lucky for you, being just dead yourself isn't the only way to avoid contacting a Jiangxi. There are more practical methods that can help you survive an encounter, some easier and some more convenient. You could decide, for example, to drop a bag of solid gold coins on the floor to escape a Jiangxi's grasp. The shiny coins that scatter across the ground will cause the hopping vampire's OCD to flare up, and it will have to stop and count the coins. Does this remind you, if anybody out there knows, one of the more obscure, I think at this point, thing myths about a vampire is that if you dump a bag of grain, it will have to stop and count the grains.
Yeah.
This is much, this, I like this. It makes more sense because, ooh, shiny. But as you can tell, this is very expensive. I don't think all of us just have bags of coins lying around. Another solution then would be to hold a Taoist symbol to your forehead. As long as the symbol is held against the head, the Jiangshi will be able to hop away. Or unable, pardon, to hop away. But the most practical way is to avoid walking the streets late at night. There you go. Simple. It's also a great way not to get mugged, assaulted, or worse. Blah, blah, blah. In fact, the Jiangshi might simply be a kind of cautionary metaphor for criminal acts that occur on dark, poorly lit streets and country roads, as many tales are, just like I said about fairy tales. There are hundreds of American and British films about vampires. Similarly, there are tons of Chinese films about Jiangshi. The most popular of these is probably the Mr. Vampire saga. I love that. Mr. Vampire, which consists of 5 films. Look it up. There are more than 30 movies that focus on the legend and terror of the Jiangshi. A more recent one, according to this article, but it looks like they're still very behind, Rigor Mortis, was released in 2013. They make for great horror films, y'all. I mean, you have probably seen the image, even if you haven't seen a full film. And if you watch anime, you've probably seen it, or a version of it. Although a lot of the anime vampires these days are also a lot sexier. They're horrific at the same time, but they don't just hop with their arms out. That's another creepy thing, is lots of times the arms are straight out, right? And it's just boing, boing, boing. Jiangshi, also, of course, is in literature. And the reason why they're dressed in ceremonial Qing Dynasty costumes is that the first stories ever published about them were released during the Qing Dynasty. One of the stories tells of how Jiangshi kills 3 people by vomiting on them. Not only is this disgusting, of course, it might also be a misunderstood account of an ancient virus that spreads through contact with bodily fluids. Either way, Jiangshi have become a staple for modern horror novelists, especially those from Southeast Asia. Their ability to mutate, the ever-changing appearance, and the mystery surrounding their power continue to interest new generations of readers. So we're not the only ones into vampires, y'all. While many people find these living dead creatures interesting, it doesn't mean that they believe in them. As with ghosts, proof or belief is often left in the hands of the individual. So the Jiangshi don't drink blood and they're not beautiful. They tend to hold their arms out before them and show clear signs of bodily decay. Are they vampires or are they zombies? The most honest answer, according to some people, is they're neither. Even though they have characteristics and qualities in common with both, they're totally unique. Again, they don't walk, they hop. They don't eat your flesh or drink your blood. They consume your energy. The belief in a soul is a very European idea, but ki and soul are nearly synonymous. So essentially, a Jiangshi is a soul eater that can infect you and turn you into the hopping dead. No, it's not funny, is it? But it is. We got the walking dead, there's a hop. Okay, never mind. And that, my friends, is the fini of today's podcast. I actually went back because I got to the end of it and I was wrapping up and I'm like, oh my God, I didn't do the best one. I forgot to read the story. I forgot to tell you about the Jiangshi. Now, with that done, and it is still dark outside, and I was hoping for fog because in October I love to walk in the fog in the morning. We're still been in the 70s, you guys. What's it like where you are? I mean, God's sakes, this is October. It's supposed to be autumn, and it's like in the 70s. Although 70 hits different in October than it does in July, but still. It's supposed to be like 57 or something. And I need my my fog for my atmospheric photographs that I like to take with barely little street lights and Halloween decorations. It's different than at night. We usually have fog throughout October here in West Seattle, but whatever. And now my cat is asleep after making all kinds of noise with the Mylar. Please check out my latest novel, Dark Wings, has a vampire in it. Please check out the omnibus that is dropping by October 31st, Halloween. I did re-release the newly edited proofed version of Paris Immortal, A Vampire Tale, with a new cover just in Kindle, $1.99. May also do some free or super cheap promos, because of course the whole idea is I want to get you sucked in and then you'll have to buy the omnibus. Yep, that's just the way it is. I took down all the old ones, especially because I started those in 2007. You know, I like to think I've improved since then. So they've been tightened up, cleaned up, and there's even edits and a new ending. That's right, I changed the ending. Not hugely. It's, for those who already know it, it's the same story you love, just better. So check it out. S. Royt, R-O-Y-T. And no, the omnibus isn't up there yet. Some people have already started to read the reissue. If you're listening, if you're looking for it and you come across this, it's not out yet, but it's coming. Okay, and that is the Pinky Pod. And remember, never answer the door when there's a stranger knocking, because it may just come in and steal your soul.